Hello, I'm Paul Cormier. This is number 0106, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Older, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Older.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0106. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actor Lee Rumor. He's one of the stars of the film Breakaway. And even though it's a comedy, his character in the film was the racist villain in the movie with a mostly East Indian cast. Was it difficult to play such a role?
It wasn't easy, to be honest, to play that role. I'm not racist, and I was the only person at the whole film who had to express the way my character Dave Martin does. It makes you feel uncomfortable, you know, and you don't want them, then, meaning, you know, the Indian culture, that everybody who was on set, it's predominantly all Indian. So I did feel uncomfortable about it, but as long as, you know, I shared some good laughter with them, so by the end of it, it was about easier.
Sean Hinckley is a Hollywood scriptwriter and also a script contest judge. He's the author of Write It to Win It. How many people who enter a script writing contest are really passionate writers looking for a career, as opposed to those who are literally panning for gold?
Probably about 50-50. You know, you get a lot of these scripts into these contests where you really get that passion shining through, and you can tell these people really pour their heart and soul into it. They've done the rewrites on it. And then you get that other 50% that are kind of like, you know, I'm just kind of here casting my script out. Hopefully I'll win and be a big writer someday. You know, it's just one of those things you can tell right away from the script. I always compare it to a first date. You know, as soon as you open that first page and you start flipping through, you get an idea of who this person is as a writer.
Christine Devine is a television news anchor who has written a book about the foster care system. How did she feel about covering foster care as a reporter?
You know, sometimes we get assignments as news anchors and you do your job. So I was doing my job. Coincidentally, my own family had fostered and adopted children. But our journey with one of the kids wasn't a it was very, very tough. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not the best advocate for this story. And turns out these kids and these families were my healers and my teachers, and I get so much love and so many hugs. It's been the best assignment ever.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0106, is Paul Cormier, the production coordinator from Global Montreal, the other place that I work. And Paul is also an avid animal lover. He wants you to check out the website Mira.ca. That's M-I-R-A, Mira.ca. Mira is an organization that supplies service dogs for people who are visually impaired or disabled. So again, check out their site for more information. That's Mira.ca. And thank you very much, Paul, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Well, a defense attorney in Titusville, Florida, was arrested after police said he threatened to kill his girlfriend and challenged her to a naked sword duel. 36-year-old Terry Lee Losey faces counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon and domestic violence battery and could get up to 5 years in prison. According to reports, Losey and his live-in girlfriend were arguing about his drinking in excess. Yes, so alcohol was involved. Losey then grabbed a mirror off a door and raised it up as if he was attempting to strike. She grabbed a hook that the mirror had been hanging on and flung it toward Losey, who suffered a cut to his head. After taking a shower, Losey then came back out naked and handed a sheathed sword to his girlfriend and said, "You're going to need this." He then allegedly grabbed a larger sword, pulled it from the sheath, and told her, "I'm going to kill you." When she tried to run, he allegedly slammed her onto the living room couch, where he punched her several times. She managed to free herself and call 911. The girlfriend told investigators that Losey left the house with the sword and was, yes, still naked. Thus, he was pretty easy to find and arrest. Wow, a guy challenging a woman to a naked sword fight should be aware of the fact that she has a lot more things to lop off with her sword than he does. I'm just saying. Moving right along, in Britain, 48-year-old Thomas Downey just got himself 16 months in jail for stealing a few Krispy Kreme donuts. He was arrested still holding the box of stolen delights, and yes, he was one of the looters in the infamous London riots. Now, if that sentence seems a bit steep to you, consider that Mr. Downey has 233 previous convictions and had just walked out of prison for number 233 at 7:30 p.m. with just $12 in his pocket. After buying cigarettes and attending a meeting for Alcoholics Anonymous, he downed a bottle of sherry. I guess that meeting was kind of frivolous. Thinking back at it now, huh? And stumbled into the donut shop in Piccadilly Gardens, Manchester, which had been damaged during the riots. Now, what I want to know is, how do you get 233 previous convictions and get out of jail? I'm all for giving someone another chance, but 233 of them? Really? Okay. In West Valley City, Utah, an 8-year-old boy, desperate for a drink of water, got the very bad idea to try to get into his neighbor's home by sliding down their chimney. This delayed his drink for about 4 hours, as he got stuck, and it took that long for firefighters to rescue him. West Valley City Police Sergeant Robert Hamilton said the thirsty boy climbed a tree to get onto the home's roof, then slid down the chimney feet first. He actually made it down about 30 feet before he became wedged between the basement and main floor. The home's owners, who had gone out to dinner, returned home to hear the kid crying in the chimney. Because of the narrowness of the chimney, as well as the twists and turns, rescuers could not pull the child out with a rope, so they had to cut an 8-by-5-foot hole in the wall to free him. Fortunately, he escaped with little more than scrapes and bruises. Okay, kid. You're that thirsty? Did you knock on the door? Okay, so nobody was home if you did that. Did you think to go and perhaps knock on another door until somebody opened? I could have made this kid idiot of the day, but I didn't. That's because he's 8. But let's let him ripen a bit. He could be a full-bore idiot in a few years. We'll just wait and see. Okay, one more story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Some people call it Montezuma's Revenge, but maybe now it should be also known as Tuscan Friars' Revenge. Angry over the recent theft of rare Bibles from their church in Tuscany, an order of Italian friars took the unusual step to pray for the unknown bandit to be struck down with a severe case of diarrhea. No, I'm not kidding. That's what they were praying for. The friars from the 15th century church of San Salvador al Monte, where, by the way, Michelangelo once worshipped, were outraged when both a rare and expensive Bible was stolen, followed by the disappearance of a replacement book donated by a local within a few hours. Now, fed up by the thefts, the group finally posted a bizarre warning, printed in both English and Italian, on the church's front door, which reads, "We pray to the Lord that these thieves are struck down by a strong case of diarrhea and that this will be a stimulus for them not to steal." Though the friars are arguably guilty of their own sins, such as praying for vengeance, one said, "But the Lord and the faithful will understand." Wow, that's not really very holy, is it? I'd say that perhaps the friar should learn to turn the other cheek, but at this juncture, all that would get them is probably splattered. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actor Lee Rameau is one of the stars of the Canadian film Breakaway, which is premiering at TIFF, the Toronto International Film Festival, on September the 10th. The film is actually set in suburban Toronto, and Lee joins us on the line now to talk about the movie and his career. Hi, Lee.
How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So you've got this big premiere coming up on the 10th of September. Are you excited?
Extremely. Yeah. Sometimes I think when I think about it, I'm lost for words. I feel honored that I'm part of this. Yeah, it's amazing.
Now, you've been at TIFF before, but not as a participant, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's right, Peter, yeah. I've been waiting 14 years, actually, for this moment. So it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
So how do you anticipate that night's going to be for you?
I think it's going to be a little overwhelming, to be honest. I'm going to be overwhelmed for sure. There's going to be just so many people and trying to remember everybody's name, you know, especially the pressure for me anyways. It's the first time for me, so I'll make sure that I'm prepped for it.
Okay.
Well, walk on the red carpet.
Tell us about the film Breakaway.
It's about Reg Veer, who's played by Vinay Vermani, who is obsessed with hockey ever since childhood and being raised as a traditional Sikh, you know, meant for him to wear a turban, which in regards to playing the game, later in the movie you find out that's what he had to do in order to play. And he has this back and forth problem with his father, who wants him to run the business, the Indian family business as a trucker. And his dream isn't to do that, it's to play hockey. So he fulfills his dream. He fulfills his dream by pursuing what he believes that he wants to do. So
There's a lot of hockey playing in the movie. Did you have to go through a lot of training for the film, or are you one of those kids who, like every other Canadian kid, plays a lot of hockey?
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of hockey in the film, yeah. And I didn't have to do crazy training for it, but I've been playing hockey since I was five. And I feel so grateful that my parents went ahead and did that. So I play hockey on a regular basis, so it was really helpful for me throughout the film. And I did learn a lot, actually, during the film, because we did have some pros and semi-pros who were also there to kind of help out, just to sharpen up some skills of all of us actors skating.
What is the character that you play in the film Breakaway?
I play Dave Murden, who is the captain to the Hammerheads, and my team is the rival team to the Speedy Things, which is the Indian team. And Vinay Vermani is the captain to that team, the Indian team, Speedy Things. And so he and I have this headbutting constant hatred on the ice. And Dave Murden, my character, doesn't think that Indians, I guess, should be playing hockey on his ice turf. So, to say the least, he's racist.
Is it too simplistic to say that this could be considered Bend It Like Beckham on ice?
I would say so. Yeah, yeah. It's an inspirational movie. You know, I'm hoping it has an impact on people out there and be educational, because it is a wonderful family film, father son. You know.
In playing the kind of role that you have in this movie, and you say the film is inspirational, and every inspirational film needs someone who has, well, a slightly villainous bent to them. Was it, in shooting this film, difficult for you to play a role like this? Because, you know, there are some people out there, unfortunately, who cannot separate fact from fiction, film from reality.
Yeah, you know, there are viewers that you know, watch a certain actor in a film, whether it be TV or film, and think that they're kind of like that person. And this film, it wasn't easy, to be honest, to play that role. I'm not racist, and being that I was the only person the whole film who had to express the way my character Dave Murden does, it makes you feel uncomfortable, you know, and you don't want them, meaning, you know, the Indian culture, that everybody who was on set, it's predominantly all Indian. So I did feel uncomfortable about it, you know, but as long as, you know, I shared some good laughter with them. So by the end of it, it got easier.
Well, sharing good laughter, one of the actors in the film is Russell Peters, who, of course, is an international comedic star.
Yeah.
What was it like being on the set with Russell?
He's not funny. I don't know why people think he's funny. He's just not funny. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, he's a pretty funny guy. I don't know. That guy is always on. He just always has something. He's clever. I mean, if you watch any of his stand-up, you can see it. That's another thing that, you know, people will be slightly offended by how he relays his jokes. But what he does is he's just trying to express and educate people as well, you know, and different kind of cultures. And I think he's pretty clever about it. And on set, he was funny, very outgoing, easy guy to talk to. Yeah, that guy was great. Also, Peters was great, yeah.
Being in a film that, as you say, is inspirational and discusses some issues that perhaps people don't necessarily want to always talk about in general population or general terms, mm-hmm. being in this type of film, that's not something that's new for you. You were on Queer as Folk.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, you know, Queer as Folk, I think, was a breaking ground for you know, gay, lesbian, and that's another show, that project that I feel absolutely honored that I was, you know, picked to be part of, and playing a recurring role, my character Troy. I learned a lot. It was one of the things where, as an actor, was a huge stepping stone for my career. And, that show for sure, I'm sure woke up a lot of people and educated some people as well.
Now, with the two roles you've been talking about, do you concern yourself or worry about being typecast as a certain type of character?
I think all actors kind of have that fear of being typecast. Yeah, it's not something I would want, but at the same time, you know, I feel as though that I have a lot to offer, that I'm talented in that. So in the auditioning room, you know, I can prove myself otherwise and hopefully book another gig where it does steer me away from those kind of characters. And lately, last year, I played another racist character towards Chinese and on Murdoch Mysteries. Phenomenal show, great show, and also, I mean, that wasn't easy. So hopefully not. This is my second time, you know, playing this type of character, but I don't think people automatically would judge and assume that this is all I can play.
Well, what have you not done that you'd like to do? What's the role you're looking for?
I wear my heart and my emotions on my sleeve, and you know, anything that has to do with, I would love to play either physically or mentally challenged type of characters. You know, Sean Penn in I Am Sam, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those films were pretty impactful for me as an actor, and inspirational. It's something that I would like to conquer. It's something else that I would love to do.
Cliff Robertson and Charlie.
I'm sorry?
Cliff Robertson and Charlie, which is another one like that.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, based on the book Flowers for Algernon, and Charlie was nominated for an Academy Award.
For
that role.
Thanks for sharing that, Peter. I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I understand you actually have another project coming up. Is it true you're getting married?
Yes, I am. thanks for asking. You just put a smile on my face.
Congratulations.
Yeah, no, I am getting married March 31st, 2012. And I'm kind of teary-eyed right now. Wow, I'm so excited. And my fiance Heidi is absolutely amazing. She's a treasure. She's a gem. And I appreciate her so much. Yeah.
Well, it looks like things are working out pretty darn well for you, and it culminates with a big premiere at TIFF coming up on September 10th. Good luck with that.
Thank you so much, Peter.
And Lee, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Oh, no, thank you. You know what? This is my first live radio show, and thank you so much. I feel honored. Great experience. Thank you.
Actor Lee Rumor, one of the stars of the Canadian film Breakaway, which is premiering at TIFF, the Toronto Film Festival, on September the 10th. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0106, and you'll find links to the film's website.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
In the air on China Airlines, on the air on stations in Singapore, New Zealand, and America, and streaming through your computer. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll meet screenwriter Sean Hinchey, and we'll also meet Christine Devine, who is a television news anchor and the author of Finding a Forever Family. Plus, of course, there's an Idiot of the Day coming your way, and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now. You know, we've all seen the reminders that come on the screen at the movie theater, like, please turn off your cell phone. Not that they do one darn bit of good. Anyway, the Warrenburg Theaters in St. Louis, which is a St. Louis theater chain that operates in both Missouri and three other states, has decided to do something about what's become a top gripe for moviegoers. Starting next month, patrons of movie complexes owned by Warrenburg who are caught using their cell phones during a movie will be escorted from the premises and not given a refund. Marketing director Kelly Hoskins says, "We're taking it to a whole new level. And it's not just the noise. Newer smartphones have screens that are so large that they can distract when being lit. And contrary to what some people might think, teens aren't the biggest offenders, according to Hoskins. Plenty of older adults ignore the common courtesy of keeping their cell phones off during the movies." As for their customers, reaction to the new policy has been great, Hoskins said. "A couple of times over the weekend, we got standing ovations when they saw the on-screen announcement." Yeah, okay. Awesome. Now, not to sound like an old fogey or anything, but I spent six of my formative teen years back in the 70s working as a movie theater usher. We used to toss people out when they did things that annoyed the rest of the paying public, never ever giving thought to giving them a refund. So I'm trying to figure out what kind of idiot thinks that they can disrupt people and then, when they're turfed, expect to get their money back. That's just lunacy. Now, this theater company says they're taking it to a new level. Just when did we originally leave that other level that used to be the norm oh so many years ago? Just asking. Just simply asking. Okay, if ever there was a time to suspect alcohol was involved, this would be it. In Bristol, Tennessee, police were called to a funeral home where workers found two intruders sleeping inside two caskets. One man escaped, but Barrett Lance Hartsock was arrested and charged with burglary and vandalism. Police said there was more than $9,000 in damage done to the caskets the two men were sleeping in. Why they were there, nobody quite seems to know the answer to that one yet. Wow, $9,000 worth of damage to two caskets by two guys who were simply sleeping in them? Somebody is really a restless sleeper. Okay, talk about your Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Looks like apes at the National Zoo in Washington knew the East Coast earthquake was about to hit before any of the humans had any idea. 5 to 10 seconds before the earth shook, an orangutan named Kyle and a gorilla named Kojo stopped foraging and suddenly raced to the top of the tree-like structure that is in their enclosure. While they were climbing to safety, another gorilla named Mandira let out a piercing shriek, grabbing her baby, Kabibi, and also heading for higher ground. Meanwhile, another orangutan named Iris was belching out warnings that something was about to happen. But zoo spokeswoman Athena Milonis said even before the apes went bananas, their less evolved cousins, the red ruffled lemurs, had been sounding the alarm for a full 15 minutes before the quake hit. Milonis said, "They are primates from Madagascar. They were the first to know. The flamingos also knew something was up minutes before the quake hit. They huddled together and stayed huddled all through the quake. However, other animals, like the giant pandas, did not appear to notice anything was amiss. And that is why one day the pandas, like us, will be extinct." Okay, time for one more story in the Stuff File News before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Now, it's not that I've ever partaken in the financial follies of the flesh, but I don't know about you. However, if I were to hypothetically find myself visiting a brothel, usually music would not be the last thing or first thing or anything on my mind. But at Donna's Ranch, a legal brothel in Wells, Nevada, 62-year-old Michael James McLemans was arrested after throwing a drink at an employee and brandishing a firearm because he was displeased with the music selections on the jukebox. Witnesses said McLemans threw a large glass of Bloody Mary at one of the employees, at which point two women removed him from the building. But then moments later, McLemans allegedly tried to get back in through the front door, but employees had locked it. He then went to the plate glass window and started banging it with his fist and a handgun. Witnesses said he was pointing the gun at the window toward the people inside. Dude, it's bad enough that you have to pay for it. Do you have to be a complete jerk as well? Anyway, let's just get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? There was a time when it was said that everybody had a book in them. Now they say everybody has a script. Sean Hinchey is a story editor and a seasoned Hollywood screenwriting contest judge. He's also the author of Write It to Win It, 39 Secrets from a Screenwriting Contest Judge. And he's on the line with us right now. Hi, Sean.
Peter, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
First of all, are there a lot of screenwriting contests?
Yeah, last time I was actually kept a list, I had accumulated, I believe it was like 330 screenplays contests that happened per year. Now, some of those contests end up going away, some get added on, but I think it's a fair guess to say that you could pretty much enter a contest per day throughout the entire year.
Now, when you come across these scripts, how many people do you find are passionate about the idea of being a screenwriter and this is something they want to do, as opposed to those who are literally panning for gold?
I'd have to say that it's probably about 50-50. You know, you get a lot of these scripts into these contests where you really get that passion shining through, and you can tell these people really pour their heart and soul into it. They've done the rewrites on it. And then you get that other 50% that are kind of like, you know, I'm just kind of here casting my script out. Hopefully I'll win and be a big writer someday. It's just one of those things you can tell right away from the script. I always compare it to a first date. You know, as soon as you open that first page and you start flipping through, you get an idea of who this person is as a writer.
Now, I said in the introduction, everybody has a book in them. Maybe nowadays everyone has a script. First of all, can everyone write a script? And I'll take that one step further. Can even every writer write a script?
You know, I don't think they can. And it's not to say that people out there aren't necessarily a good writer or aren't passionate about what they do. But, you know, screenwriting is really about taking a story and condensing it down to roughly a two-hour movie. Now, when you write a script, it works out to about a page a minute. So you're really cramming an entire story into 120 pages. And for a lot of people, they tend to, stretch out the story. They take a kernel of an idea and put a lot of filler in, not realizing that every scene really needs to punch. It really needs to shine through. And you need to captivate your audience not only from page one, but you really need to carry them across the finish line so, you know, the person reading your script or seeing your movie in the theater feels fulfilled.
You know, it just so happens that just the other night I decided to rewatch one of my favorite older films. It was a Hitchcock film, as a matter of fact. It was Dial M for Murder. And the thing that caught my eye when I was watching it, because it's the first time I had seen it basically as an adult, the thing I noticed was the tightness of the script. And not to sound like an old fogey, but do they write them like they used to?
You know, Peter, first of all, you're making my heart swoon. Hitchcock is just a master of storytelling. Dial M for Murder is an excellent movie. One of my favorites is North by Northwest. But to go back to your question, I think a lot of writers do have the knack of telling stories like they used to. It's just that I think the audiences expect a different pacing these days. Hitchcock had a way of really getting you into the characters and sort of teasing you into the story, and it just seems like storytelling nowadays is more about hitting you hard, you know, getting you into the story in 5 minutes and, you know, just really racing you across the finish line. It's more like a drag racing car versus a little touring car through the mountains. So I just think in that sense, it's not that people aren't telling them like they used to. They just kind of put a different spin on the art of storytelling.
Well, is the audience really different today, or is it between the screenwriter and the audience, there are the studio suits, and there are what's really different today?
Well, I think the problem today with the whole studio system is, movies need to make their money back in that first weekend. So, which is why you have a lot of these tentpole, the high-octane, high-action movies. So there's a lot of pressure for them to, you know, make their $100 million in that first weekend because movies are always coming out. And I think because of that, you know, the movies seem to be a lot louder, a lot more special effects, and the story's a little bit safer. You know, you don't have a lot of these stories that make you really want to think and put the pieces together. Everything's a bit more spoon-fed or just a bit more simple. I do think there is a place for the art house movies, a lot of the independent movies, but, you know, again, the studios are in the business of making money, so they're going to go with the low-hanging fruit.
Now, as a screenwriting judge, what are some of the common mistakes you find in the scripts that you judge?
I think one of the biggest mistakes has to do with formatting errors. There's a certain way a screenplay needs to look on the page, and in some ways it's almost a technical form of writing. You know, you have your description going from margin to margin, whereas the person speaking is going to be centered on the page in capital letters, and the dialogue is going to be squeezed in a little bit in the center, probably roughly 2 inches from each margin. Unlike with a novel, when someone is speaking, you use, you know, quotations, a lot of commas, that type of thing. So I see a lot of people just improperly formatting their screenplay. And another biggie is actually a lot of spelling errors. It's amazing how in this era of spell check, how many errors get through. And then aside from the formatting errors, though, I think a lot of it just has to do with the, like what I spoke to about earlier, people set up the story, and then they're just sort of filling in space until they get to the end of the story where they can dazzle you. They somehow, I don't know, it's almost as if they think, if I have a great ending, the rest of the screenplay will be forgotten and I'm going to win the contest.
Mm. And as a judge, what are you looking for?
I am looking for a great story told in an excellent fashion. And I'm not particular to any genre. Of course, I have the genres of movies that I enjoy watching. But there's a misconception that people do not like horror scripts, or they don't like westerns or period pieces, etc. For me, I don't care what the story is about. I just want you to engage me from the very beginning. I want to know who these characters are. I really want to believe in them. When you have a great villain, I want to hate the villain. You know, write a great villain that I want to despise for the entire screenplay. And I want to go on a journey with your characters in your story for the entire run. I don't want to be bored. I don't want to be spoon-fed information, on the other hand. You know, you don't need to lay everything right on the line. I want to think a little bit, and by the end of the story, I want to be changed. I want to be affected by your storytelling. And not a lot of writers can do that.
As someone entering a contest, should they be concerned with the probability of a film being made? And again, the reason why I bring that up is, as I'm sure you're aware, unless you're making an animated film, you can put anything you want in a script, especially if it's an action film, from explosions to whatever the case may be. But if it can't fit into a budget, it's not going to get made. Do you have to concern yourself with that when you're writing for a screenwriting contest?
Absolutely. You're 100% right on that one, and I actually talk about it in my book. When you're writing a screenplay and you're entering it in a contest, you really need to look beyond the contest. It's one thing to win the contest, but if you talk to most writers, what do they really want to do? They want to sell the screenplay, and they want to see it on the big screen. So the whole crux of my book is not only how to win a contest, but how to use it as a catapult to expand your screenwriting career. And going back to your point, to do that, you need to write the script that can be made. You need to make something that's visual, something that can be cast. I've read so many screenplays, I'm flipping through it, and I'm like, I just can't imagine who would play this role. As an example, I read one screenplay years ago, and it had a group of vampires. This is before the current vampire craze, but they're all in their late 80s. And I'm thinking, who can you actually put in this role? Now, if they went back and changed the age of the characters, maybe made them younger, made them immortal, kind of like what they're doing in movies, you've opened up a whole palette of actors and actresses that can play these roles. So absolutely, write the script that not only will win the contest, but can sell.
The book is called Write It to Win It, 39 Secrets from a Screenwriting Contest Judge. I thank you very, very much, Sean, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you very much. I had a great time.
Sean Hinchey, author of Write It to Win It, 39 Secrets from a Screenwriting Contest Judge. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0106, and you'll find links to Sean's site and also links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever seen a comic strip that was so funny you just had to share it with someone? Now, I know this is radio, but I saw a comic recently that I'd like to share with you. It comes from the popular comic strip Pearls Before Swine. In this strip, one of the characters is reading a long list of warning labels. The warnings include, use extreme caution when moving the product, and take extreme care when the product is in use. Sounds extremely dangerous, doesn't it? Well, after several panels of warnings, the character appears with the product and says, I've never been so afraid of a toaster. Let's be fair, that's only a comic strip, but like most comics, it's based in reality. It wasn't too long ago that I told you a true story about a woman who became so concerned after reading the warnings on her heating pad that she refused to use it. If you'd like to see this comic strip and a video about the real story behind wacky warning labels that's now airing nationwide, visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Christine Devine, who is a television news anchor. Plus, she's the author of Finding a Forever Family, talking a little bit about the foster care system. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day coming your way as well. But right now, more Stuff File news before we get to our next guest. If you listen to the show on a regular basis, you know that we love our truck spills, and this one is a classic. In Nashville, a U.S. interstate was temporarily shut down during the morning commute after four small propane-sized canisters were found dropped on the highway. Now, the canisters began to emit a light vapor and reportedly had a very unpleasant odor. Not knowing what they were, authorities took all the necessary precautions. They then got a call from a Greyhound bus driver who reported that he had lost a part of his cargo load while negotiating the ramp. So the bus driver turned around to retrieve the canisters, which were full of nothing harmful, just frozen bull semen. That's right, frozen bull semen. They were stored on dry ice. Anyway, boy, you never know what's on a Greyhound bus these days. Do you? Moving right along, so you're sitting around with the family just watching TV when you hear a loud boom on your roof. So you go to investigate and you find an SUV with three people inside sitting in your attic. Thus was the fate of the Brown family in Kansas City. Michelle Brown said her son discovered the SUV as he was leaving to go to the store. He said, "Mama, there's a truck in the ceiling." And I'm like, "A truck in the ceiling?" And we all ran outside to take a look. Police said they believe the driver of the SUV was speeding when he drove up onto the lawn in front of the home, which acted like a ramp, sending the vehicle airborne and into the home's attic. The three people in the SUV were taken to hospital for treatment of their injuries. They're expected to recover. In the meantime, the Red Cross is helping the Browns with temporary shelter. Now, you just know that there aren't enough appropriate insurance forms to cover this one. Can you just see somebody going into their insurance office saying, "Yeah, I'd like to make a claim. Yeah, there is a car in my attic." Attic. Yeah. And finally, before we get to our next guest, one more story here on the Stuff File News. This is the kind of story, by the way, that would probably draw the attention of Bob Dorigo Jones of Let's Be Fair fame, which you heard just a few moments ago. An innovative former Florida State University professor is suing his former employer with a wrongful termination suit because he says his drinking problem is a handicap. Frank Stevenson, who is the director, or at least he was the director for research communications at FSU, is asking for $75,000 to compensate for emotional distress and damage to his career and reputation. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Isn't being a drunk itself damaging a career and reputation? Anyway, in the bizarre claim, Stevenson said the university should have provided reasonable accommodations for his handicap of alcoholism, which the suit says his supervisors were well aware of. Of course, Florida state law prohibits discrimination against any person with a handicap. Stevenson was fired in September 2010 after an employee he supervised filed a complaint against him, alleging that he was abusive towards employees. Wow, boy, he and his lawyer really have a set on them, don't they? Amazing. Anyway, let's get to our final guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Christine Devine is an Emmy Award-winning television news anchor. She is also the author of Finding a Forever Family, a news anchor's notebook on domestic adoption within the foster care system. She's on the line with us right now from California. Hi, Christine.
That sounds so official, doesn't it? That's a very long title. We wanted to get all the keywords in domestic, you know, because it differs from international adoption, foster care. It differs from, you know, a child, maybe an infant who's not been in foster care. So we cover a lot of things with that title.
Now, this is a book that, and this was a story you, I understand you originally covered that you weren't necessarily keen on doing.
No. You know, sometimes we get assignments as news anchors, and you do your job. So I was doing my job. Coincidentally, my own family had fostered and adopted children. But our journey with one of the kids wasn't a it was very, very tough. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not the best advocate for this story. And turns out these kids and these families were my healers and my teachers, and I get so much love and so many hugs. It's been the best assignment ever.
Okay, so what, I mean, as you say, you didn't want to do the story initially, but obviously your mind changed as you went along. Doing your job and doing the story is one thing. Taking it further and then writing a book about it, what led to that?
Well, the book came about after one of our little guys died after a car accident. And he was the one kid that kind of had become the kid I mentored. He was like my little tag-along. He came to Emmys with me. He came to our house for Christmas, and we went to his birthday party. And when you cover a story or, like, adoption with kids, you cover so many firsts, the first high school graduation, the first adoption. You never think you're going to say goodbye to a little kid. So we used his passing to be a voice beyond Los Angeles, California.
So in this case, is writing this book, or was writing this book, kind of cathartic for you?
A lot of the catharsis, well, it was, and I talked with my family about our journey, because one of my the kids that we took in ended up falling into drugs and died of a drug overdose. You got to keep in mind, these kids are in foster care because there's been abuse or neglect or abandonment in their own families. That's why they're there. I mean, my own brother was born in prison to a drug-addicted mother.
Wow.
So, to deal with that and come to terms and ask questions of the families and to talk with my mother, why this, why that? Yes, it was.
Do you think attitudes need to be changed around the world on this topic? And the reason why I say that is sometimes people tend to go with guilt by association. You mentioned your own brother was born in prison. That is not his fault. That's his mother. But it's sometimes a stigma that people like that carry along with them through their lives.
Well, he was introduced to drugs by a neighborhood kid at 12 years old, so I don't know if there are some addiction issues there. Then you couple that with anger or pain or unhappiness. He said he was very sad. And what we need to work on is we got to keep in mind these kids are going to be in our societies, all of our societies. And so our families, especially here in California, we really work with meeting the child's needs so the child can heal what they need to heal, not what the parent needs. And my coordinator was such a strong advocate of meeting the child's needs. Because remember, these kids grow up to be adults.
Right. Now, we're talking about foster care, which is not exactly the same thing as adoption. The situation with foster care is there's always the potential, I guess there's always the hope, that maybe children and parents can be reunited, correct?
Well, I would like to be out of business altogether. I wish we never had to deal with this topic, but unfortunately we do. So kids in foster care largely are there for protection for hopefully a short period of time while the family can work to try to get, you know, get their act together and reunite the family. That's really the number one goal. I deal with the kids where that's just not going to happen. The courts have ruled it's just not going to be the future for this child because the parents aren't making the change to make it happen. And they're going to linger in foster care forever if they don't find an adoptive family.
So in writing this book, Finding a Forever Family, who do you want to talk to the most? Who do you want to reach the most with your book?
Number one, anybody who wants to adopt, who's been adopted, who's thinking about it, it's really the inside journey. It's the highs, the lows, the ups and downs, the pros and cons. And I took five families who really influenced my life and asked them to share their journey. And these are families who are not giving up. One family's adopted three, one of ours, and then two more. Another family has adopted six, three siblings, then three siblings, and they want three more. So these are families that are really in the fight for kids who need a place to call home. So it's that, or it's for anybody who wants to be inspired by somebody who found themselves in the least likely of places and serving. You know, we all are called upon at some point in life, I think.
It takes a very special kind of person. Unfortunately, we live in a sort of me generation. And, I mean, you mentioned people who want to adopt a certain number of kids. I know a lot of people who don't want that many of their own natural kids, never mind adopting kids. It takes a special breed of person, doesn't it?
It sure does. And I really say it's not for everybody, and it's so important to work to find the right fit and the right match. I have one family who says, too, if it doesn't feel like it's the right fit, don't make that match. Don't take that child because in the long run, it's not going to work for your family. You've got to find the right match. But the families I work with, Peter, are so great in that some women cry to me and say, you gave me that family I always wanted. I never had kids, and now I have a family.
And there is somewhat of a balancing act, as you say, in finding that right family. And the reason why I say that, I'm talking about it from the parental point of view. You open up your heart. You want to help these children. You know that these are children that, to a certain amount of degree, have had rejection in their life.
Sure, they have.
And you don't want to be the person to say, oh, I really want to help, but this is not the right fit. That must be very hard.
I think it's important, though. You know, there's a class you can take. It's called a MAP class here in the States. And you learn all about the process and the services. But you have to go through safety checks and background checks and home inspections. It's so important that you find a good fit because it's going to be a tough journey as it is. These kids have been, I mean, some kids have been in 5 and 8 foster homes. Think if that was you.
Yeah.
It might come in with a little bit of, you know, I had one kid. He was from a family of, it was a gang family, and the older brother taught him at 5 years old to steal from the liquor store. His fabulous adoptive mom said, no, we're not going to live our life like that. We don't steal.
Hmm. In doing these stories initially on television that you did, in writing this book, how has this experience changed you?
It took a while for me to feel comfortable talking about the topic as an advocate. I could do my story, you know, unbiased journalist and do my story, and kids are fantastic. But to talk about it and to be a voice, I had one little kid. We were on a shoot. He didn't say two words the whole shoot. At the end, I said, bye. He looked up at me and said, when am I going to see you again? Ooh. And I realized that I can be there for these kids in a maybe indirect, some a more direct way, that they look to me. I had one kid call me and say, I'm getting adopted a year later. I mean, he kept my business card and called me and wanted me to know he found a family a year later.
So in a way, you're almost a beacon to some of these children.
Well, one family asked me to be the godmom for their son. So Darnell's my godson. We took him to Washington to speak before a congressional committee, and he's fantastic. He's a role model. At Christmas, he went out and gave Christmas cards to people on the homeless people on the streets. We're creating young ambassadors, and I tell the kids, you've been through a lot, and I want you to help somebody else down the road.
The book is called Finding a Forever Family, News Anchor's Notebook on Domestic Adoption Within the Foster Care System. It's written by Christine Devine, I guess the aptly named Christine Devine. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you for letting me share the message, and I just really appreciate getting to help erase this stigma, because there's some beautiful children out there who just want to be policemen and firefighters and teachers, and we got to get them there.
Christine Devine, author of Finding a Forever Family, a News Anchor's Notebook on Domestic Adoption Within the Foster Care System. You can find her website at christinedevine.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0106, and you'll find links to the site and also links to amazon.com, where you can order her book directly for the Kindle. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Okay, this one is a special case because I don't know exactly who should get this week's award because I don't have the individual's name. So I'm going to give it to whomever is the pinhead in a certain baseball team's PR department. That's who gets it. Apparently, the Newark Bears minor league baseball team believes the old adage that there's no such thing as bad publicity. But they've raised more than a few eyebrows by sending off departing pitching coach Jim Leyritz, who was acquitted of DUI manslaughter in November, with a $2,000 donation to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Now, at first glance, this sounds like a nice gesture, doesn't it? Problem is, they're doing it on the same night as their weekly beer pong tournament. Now, to quote directly from the press release, the Newark Bears are donating $2,000 to MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, as a special farewell to one of their coaches, Jim Leyritz. The Bears hope to help draw awareness during the team's last Thirsty Thursday of the season. $20 gets you admission to the game and beer pong tournament. The winner will receive 50% of proceeds generated from the tournament registrations. Fans will also have the opportunity to get autographs from Coach Leyritz and the team's other coaches at the event, including Ozzie Canseco, who just happened to be arrested and charged with a DUI in Florida in January. Wow, is everyone in the chain of command with the Newark Bears completely out to lunch? Nah. I'm just guessing that collectively they constitute a big, steaming, heaping, helping of idiots.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0106. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And by going to the Stuff File, you'll find all the information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And again, that's number 0106. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. And you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.